来嘛来嘛，不要死嘞！等你嘞，不要死嘞！等你嘞，来嘛来嘛，哎，来哎来哎来哎，不要死嘞！
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm Nick Cheeseman, a research fellow at the Australian National University. Today I'm talking with Sopal Ye, an associate professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, California, about his 2013 book, Aid Dependence in Cambodia, How Foreign Assistance Undermines Democracy, published by Columbia University Press. Sopal, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nick.
So this book is as much the result of a personal journey, a family struggle for survival, as it is a case study of Cambodia as a laboratory for international donors' experiments, as you put it. Before we go into the contents of the book itself, can you please tell us a little bit about that journey?
Well, I was born in Cambodia just before the Khmer Rouge took power in April 75. So I was born in December 1974. Well, we don't exactly know when. A lot of Cambodians don't have their precise birth dates. But one of five kids, and my mother and father and siblings and I were all sent to the countryside. We were Phnom Penh dwellers, and probably the enemies, most likely the very enemies of the Khmer Rouge in terms of living bourgeois lives and such, and sent to Pursat province, where we had no relatives and no knowledge of the environment. And my mom was essentially my parents were made to work the country side rice fields, when one day the Khmer Rouge cadres told the entire commune that Cambodians would be allowed, Vietnamese would be allowed to leave Cambodia. This was an amazing sort of moment, because at that time, I think Pol Pot was too busy with internal struggles and such to pay much attention to what was going on with the Vietnamese. They weren't yet at war with Vietnam, and if it had happened later, it would have been a trap. But at that moment, it was actually an opportunity, and my mom had many Vietnamese friends as a child, had picked up some Vietnamese language, and thought she could pretend to be Vietnamese. And my dad didn't speak a word of Vietnamese, so they signed up. It took several months to even get called for that journey, but when the journey began, my father passed away from dysentery and malnutrition. The problem that would have presented itself had he actually lived would have been, how would he have passed? So now my mom and five kids are off to the border with Vietnam, and she's tested by Khmer Rouge cadres, passes, and then has to take another exam to get across to Vietnam, but this one administered by Vietnamese cadres. Communist cadres, and her Vietnamese is actually very basic. She'd learned it in the marketplace with her friends and as a young girl, and it was so bad, in fact, that she gave had given all the children new names, Vietnamese names, but her Vietnamese was bad because she'd given the boys girls' names and the boys' girls' names. So she had reversed all the genders, and it was a Vietnamese lady that explained to her this little problem and tutored her for the next couple of days, and she was able to pass as a result of that. And my siblings and I were able to get to Vietnam as a result of my mom's heroic actions. Then onwards, and it's a long story, I won't get into too many details, but after 2 years in Vietnam, onwards to France as Cambodian refugees, and as immigrants to the U.S., at least for three of the kids, two were already adults and stayed in France, but three of the kids, including myself, obviously, got to the U.S., and my mom was able to live a new life in America beginning in 1985 until she passed away in 2009, after I had the opportunity to thank her on a stage at the TED conference for what she'd done. So it was, it's, I think it, it really anchors sort of my raison d'être, this belief that I was given an opportunity to live thanks to her actions, thanks to the actions of strangers throughout my life and hers, and that I should try as much as possible to give back to the country of my birth, to help Cambodia develop and essentially be democratic as much as it can be.
So why did you concentrate on international aid or international development projects?
Well, I'd worked for the World Bank for 3 years, seeing up close the effects of a donor like the bank. And then I spent a year in East Timor working for the UN Development Program. And it gave me a chance to kind of examine the way in which development works. Development, it's interesting. When I was a grad student at Berkeley doing my PhD, I kind of assumed that development was always a good thing. And of course, you know, what does development mean in the first place? I had a professor there, Jim Robinson, who is now at Harvard, who said, for example, at one point that when speaking with a Cambodian villager near Sihanoukville, that for this villager, development meant they build a road and take my land away. But that's really the extreme, and that's sort of the problems with development aid that I was trying to get at. Like, how can development sometimes have negative consequences? How can good intentions lead to disaster? And I guess I was trying to see, having observed donors operate in Cambodia, I was trying to determine how perhaps the outcomes I'd found in my dissertation about, you know, looking at the relationship between aid and various dimensions of governance, how aid might affect negatively the rule of law, for example, could play out in Cambodia. And it's just a case study, certainly, of looking after having seen, after having done large and sort of statistical analysis, to then see whether one can find the possible mechanism by which aid could hurt certainly one dimension of governance and possibly others. I mean, we're constantly told of the stories of how, you know, aid can be used for corruption. Aid can siphon resources from the public sector in terms of human resources. Good people who would have worked to help their governments instead are sucked into the aid industrial complex. And certainly in the case of Cambodia, how aid manifested itself in the situation with bird flu, avian influenza, how it's been seen as counterproductive in the case of Bangkok Lake, the lake that was purchased by a Chinese firm headed by a Cambodian senator of the ruling party, and then filled in while the World Bank at that time was doing land titling around Phnom Penh and was somehow duped into not giving land titles to the people around the lake, for example. So sometimes, you know, development projects that intend to do well can be captured by the authorities and turned to their purposes, basically used to steal land from people to appropriate resources that aren't theirs because they can suddenly grab them.
We'll come to some of those specific examples that you've offered momentarily, but before we do that, I'd like to go into book's contents with a more general question, and that is,
sure,
thinking about what you've just said on critiques of international development projects. The critiques of such projects are not new. Since the 1990s, certainly they've been abundant. So So why did you need to write this book in particular, aside from its manifest importance to you as a Cambodian? What does the case study of Cambodia bring to the larger discussion about the problems of aid and its delivery?
Well, I think Cambodia, when assessed as an example of a post-conflict country that received, at least in the early 90s, the largest peacekeeping UN peacekeeping mission in the organization's history, you know, what was essentially the impact of that $2 to $3 billion US dollar peacekeeping mission? How can it be sort of evaluated from the standpoint of what did the UN do from the beginning that might have set Cambodia on a course for the outcomes one observes now? So, you know, in the overall picture, I see it as a contribution to the study of post-conflict countries, of which there are quite a number now, and also to see, how a country becomes normal. So one of the interesting things that a friend of mine who served at the U.S. Embassy would say was essentially that Cambodia was becoming a normal country. And by normal, I think he meant normal in the sense of like every other developing country, which is to say, with all the attendant problems of developing countries, the lack of resources, financial and human, the corruption that comes with a lot of that development aid and with the resources that come with investors who see opportunities but also want to obtain unfair advantages once in country, and perhaps to use that as a case study for Myanmar, for example. So I got the chance a couple of years ago to meet Aung San Suu Kyi and to give her a copy of the book, she was very grateful. She said that Myanmar needed, to learn from Cambodia's experience because after all, she wanted to avoid the problems of Cambodia, problems which are, I think, well-recognized problems having to do with how the same prime minister has continued to rule the country since 1985, 30 years this year anniversary, and the longest non-monarch in Southeast Asia, really. So I don't think Burma is on track for that quite yet, but there's a lot that can be avoided. Things like what Cambodia did with its garment sector, what worked, what didn't, and why, and perhaps now that Myanmar is obtaining its own garment sector, where it should go from there, how monitoring and evaluation and checking of factories and their labor standards could help that country perhaps avoid the problems of Bangladesh, for example, which has suffered with the collapse of Rana Plaza, killing thousands. This is really, I think, an opportunity to learn from Cambodia's experience.
Let's go into some of the problems in more detail. You have four chapters in the book that substantive contents are concentrated in. The first chapter begins by asking the question, does aid make government or governance worse? What was the answer that you obtained to that question in the case of Cambodia, and how did you arrive at that answer?
Right. Well, first, I it's not apparent in I spared the reader all the tables, but I ran all of the data I could at the time from the World Bank and the OECD on foreign aid, and then using the governance indicators of the World Bank across six dimensions, control of corruption, regulatory quality, rule of law, among others, and try to tease out a relationship globally, not necessarily with Cambodia. And that's where there was this, with all kinds of controls and methods, there seemed to be a negative relationship that persisted between aid and rule of law. And in the case of Cambodia, I tried to hone in a bit more and try to figure out what might be causing, if there is in fact a global negative relationship between aid and the rule of law, how that might be happening. So I looked at the possibility that, you know, laws could be written in ways that end up not benefiting those whom it for whom the law intends to help. So, you know, if you are doing land titles, for example, could you end up having a law that essentially gives the land title itself to the wrong party, to the party that is in power, or to its cronies, for example? And certainly in the case of Cambodia, there's evidence to suggest that the authorities have been very good at manipulating donors. So it's certainly in that instance what I mentioned earlier about Bangkok Lake. In another sort of way that I try to display the astuteness of the authorities in Cambodia, I track, for example, the amount of the levels of commitments that donors have given to Cambodia, despite, you know, annual sort of complaints about corruption in Cambodia, lack of reform in Cambodia, and so on, lack of results. And yet they would give more than the authorities asked for, which was obviously a signal that then the authorities could then play up and say, you know, look, we asked for 500 million, but got 600 million, or we asked for, you know, 700 million and got 800 million. Ways in which they can signal that kind of, approval of their actions. I think that generally, you know, the country, the data that I point to is of relatively high aid dependence. So what do I mean by that? From 2002 to 2010, the support, the level of aid, the proportion of aid of net official development assistance relative to government budget was 94.3%, if I'm correct, averaging over those 8 years. And that's basically saying that for every dollar the government of Cambodia spent, it received nearly a dollar in foreign aid, which I think is really a testament to how a country, even a decade plus removed from coming back into the international community, could still be seen as needing high levels of foreign aid. This is a country that at that time was growing at nearly 7%+ per year. I mean, depending on when you start the clock, possibly even double digits. High growth, high levels of aid coinciding with that growth. So, one would think that there would be a lower dependence on foreign aid. And there's certainly a weaning off. I mean, the Cambodian economy is growing rapidly. It isn't in need in as much, the proportion of aid is smaller relative to GDP. But it's still a very large amount of aid coming to Cambodia, despite, protestations from donors that Cambodia is often doing the wrong thing or not paying enough attention or taking years to pass, even decade plus to pass an anti-corruption law, for example.
Who is giving all of this aid and for what are they giving it?
Right. So, you've got Japan as the usual, large donor, but of course, increasingly China is by far the biggest donor now. It's come in as kind of behemoth. In 1997, when the ruling parties undertook us has to be called a coup d'état, really, in July of 97. This was a kind of experiment in cutting off aid. So, as a protest, lots of donors suspended their aid packages. And the authorities at that point learned to diversify because they realized that they couldn't depend on Western donors who could coordinate their actions and say, okay, Cambodia, you've had a coup. We're not going to continue giving you the same level of aid. We're going to suspend the money. And as a result, the authorities kind of opened up to, you know, China definitely endorsing that, you know, one state policy and not recognizing Taiwan. And as a result, coming into favor with China and receiving ever-increasing amounts of aid. And I think the real example of that commitment was in, I believe it was in December of 2009 when Xi Jinping came to Cambodia. And the day before, 20 Uyghurs were sent back to China. 20 Uyghurs tried to seek asylum, to be declared refugees by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and who instead were put on a chartered jet and brought back to China and haven't been since heard from. But Xi Jinping arrived in Siem Reap, Cambodia, the day after and signed, if I recall correctly, something like $1.2 billion in aid and investment for Cambodia. So it was a clear signal of a kind of quid pro quo. And then, of course, you know, later in 2012, Cambodia chaired ASEAN and became a kind of spokesperson for China. I mean, it took China's position on the South China Sea. In its November 2012 meeting, it even used the word ASEAN did not want to internationalize the South China Sea dispute, which was a literal word from the playbook of the Chinese authorities at that point. The spokesperson for China at that point had used that term. So, China is undisputably the biggest player. It doesn't behave transparently with respect to how much aid it gives. There are lots of numbers thrown around, but it clearly has walked in with deep pockets. And as the African proverb goes, when your hand is in another man's pocket, you must walk where he walks.
You conducted a perception survey on the quality of governance and success or failure in aid delivery. Can you explain what that survey was about and what your findings were?
Right. Well, I was trying essentially to target people who were deeply involved in development work in Cambodia, and essentially to assess the success or failure of aid in Cambodia. So I was trying to obtain from them a sense of how much of what worked and what didn't. And one of the interesting aspects, of course, was that essentially, there was a sense that that political stability, there was the political stability had been helped in Cambodia over the years. And that's an obvious, artifact of the prime minister not having changed, really. I mean, this is the same person in charge for now 3 decades, but at that time it wasn't quite 3 decades, and so a medium, 67% of informants rated it as medium to very high in terms of political stability. The areas where there was really very little success were rule of law and control of corruption. Control of corruption enjoying about 7% of medium to very high rank, and then rule of law about 12%. So everything else is either none to poor, or it doesn't really add up to quite the level of support or rather success that informants saw in in that specific dimension of governance. as a result of donor success. And you can kind of see that. I mean, control of corruption. Cambodia ranks as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It perennially ends up not at the very bottom, but certainly in the bottom quartile of Transparency International's corruption perception index. So it's a definite laggard in that area. And in terms of the rule of law, well, what's more notorious in Cambodia than a corrupt judicial system, one that isn't independent, one that takes orders from the executive branch to go after whoever has been targeted for arrest. Even today, a senator has been arrested from the opposition party for posting on Facebook a treaty that apparently was fake or whatnot. And so I don't know whether his parliamentary immunity had been lifted or if they even bothered with that process. He's currently under arrest. Then you've got, every day all kinds of incredible injustices involving the courts. So that's definitely an area where there continues not to be success, and there continues to be essentially impunity.
In the second chapter, you tie this discussion of corruption and government ineffectiveness into the role of oligarchs, the clientelistic style of politics in Cambodia, and the problems to do with taxation. Can you speak to some of the aspects of the second chapter that tie into these themes?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, it's really the idea there is that the oligarchs, the Akhnyas of Cambodia, these are the tycoons, they've been given official peerage title, they're really quite interesting to study. I mean, I call it the Akhnya economy because it really appears to be an economy run by these tycoons that essentially control different sectors. So, the garment sector, there are certainly tycoons there, but it's the one example of a sector, I argue, that has succeeded or that has managed to control the amount of corruption it has to pay, and as a result, was able to survive this process. Rice is another sector that I study, in which I argue, there's lots of potential there. They could export lots of rice, and I think they're finally starting to do that. But you saw a kind of, this kind of jockeying by the tycoons to control the sector because of the amount of money that could be made. The good thing is, in my view, they haven't been able to corner it, and it has continued to be able to actually escape capture. So at one point, a Ministry of Commerce entity called Green Trade was going to essentially capture the rice sector for itself, and it would have been controlled by the then Minister of Commerce. But instead, it was thankfully blocked, and there were other entrants that were allowed to export because, there was a rice crisis in 2008. A lot of countries banned the export of rice, and that was used as a kind of an opportunistic moment to try to take control over the sector. But it didn't last long enough for them to succeed. And so they they failed to overtake it. And then finally, the livestock sector in Cambodia. That's another sector that I think had lots of potential, but it's really an example of a failed sector in the sense that any hope that that livestock could be exported, and at one point it was exported to Malaysia legally, passing sanitary and phytosanitary standards, were dashed because of corruption. I mean, I described in the book instances of police following trucks full of cattle, chasing them around, wanting $100 per truck, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up. And then when the exporter, a Malaysian joint venture with one of the ironically, one of the tycoons, went on barges instead to try to escape the police. They went on patrol boats chasing after his barges to demand bribes. So unfortunately for the livestock sector, it hasn't escaped the clutches of corruption, and as a result has so far not been able to realize its potential. Now, the argument I make about taxation is really simple. It's this idea that in a democracy, people pay taxes, they expect services, and one expects that there's a link then between taxation and accountability, because if you pay your taxes, you expect services and you expect your government to be responsive to your needs. Now, Cambodia has managed somehow to avoid that because while it taxes officially, it does not seem to collect a very impressive amount of revenues. In fact, at the time that I was writing this, it languished at the sort of the African, sub-Saharan African levels of tax revenue collection, which was, I think, in the 8% of GDP range. And I argue that essentially this is a kind of a strange situation. So aid comes in and allows the authorities to not tax as much because aid substitutes for taxation. And then how do the authorities, the authorities could simply say, okay, well, we'll take the foreign aid and then we'll not tax as much. That's one way of looking at things. They're, of course, answering to the donors more than they would be to the taxpayers. But, of course, that's not what the authorities only do. What they also do is they then go off into the unofficial tax racket and are able to collect hundreds of millions, and now it's estimated even as high as 10% of GDP in corruption money. So effectively they've turned what would have been a normal country that taxed a reasonable amount into one that taxes 8% officially, and then possibly another 10% unofficially, and doesn't, of course, use that 10% of GDP to develop itself. It uses it for the officials that collect the money use it for consumption and for politicking, buying votes, and things like that. Some of that does return to the villages when the politicians come back with gifts and so on, but it's not nearly as systematic as if it were an actual public service, like hospitals and schools that don't require students to pay bribes or patients to pay before being admitted, for example. So donors are in a way kind of subsidizing the authorities' ability to continue this regime, and in a way preventing the accountability that's required from the link between taxation and people and their government through democracy.
But are you implying by that absence of this level of money coming in the form of aid from abroad, a superior system of taxation would emerge? It seems to me that there are many aspects to this story, some of which you spell out in the book, and it's not just a problem of tax exemptions or relatively low amounts of tax formally collected, but even you describe how it's cumbersome to pay tax, that there are enterprises that try to pay tax and finds that it's more trouble than it's worth.
Is
it all part of the same story, or are there other strands here that somehow we're not catching hold of?
Well, I think it is. I doubt that it's a systematic attempt to prevent the payment of taxes. If that were the case, then people would be better off in some ways, at least. If somebody is trying to pay their taxes and is being told, we can't be bothered counting your money, which is what I describe in the book has happened. But I don't think that it's at the level of the policymaker is saying, we have to stop them from paying taxes. We have to stop them from paying taxes. No, what they're doing is they want their bribe money to count your tax payment, and they can't be bothered to do so. So So you've got to pay somebody to then, you know, transfer the money over into the treasury's account, bank account, so that you don't even have to show up and wait all day to have the money counted. But I guess what I'm getting at is really that corruption has become so pervasive that it's even infected the very sort of institutions that are supposed to be collecting taxes. I mean, one would think that collecting taxes would be like, you know, something that you'd want to do. I mean, that as a government, you would want to make sure that it is as easy as possible for people to pay their taxes and not make it difficult for them. But instead, the short-sightedness of the authority seems to linger around the area of how to, at every point of entry, make it, how to put a little barrier. So I'll just give you another example. You know, I return to Cambodia a couple of times a year, and while it used to be nearly 100% of the time that I would be asked to pay a bribe at the immigration counter, it's now probably more like 50%. But the problem is that it's even 50%. I don't know, you know, out of two times going in and coming out, which ones I'll be asked to pay a bribe for. And so as a result, I'm just, you know, stressed out and angry whenever I'm about to land, because I know there's a good chance that I might be asked, and whenever I'm about to leave, because again, there'll be a good chance that I'll be asked to pay a bribe. And this is despite a sign on the immigration booth saying no need to pay anything here. And it's written in English, it's written in Cambodian. It is supposed to communicate the idea that, you know, this is voluntary. Of course it's voluntary. I mean, they call it tipping, but I don't know of too many government officials across the world that would stoop to that level. And I jokingly say that they should simply just put a tip jar next to their, on their counter, and let people decide whether they want to tip them or not, but make it transparent at least. Don't turn it into a little bit of a under the table transaction every time somebody returns. It's awful, and it's not happening. If it were only happening to Cambodians, it'd be one thing. But then it started happening to foreigners as well. Americans visiting Cambodia being asked to tip, and then writing letters to newspapers as a result. And then Chinese visitors being asked to tip, and being told they have to go to the back of the line unless they're willing to put in a few yuan tip, and unfortunately for that situation, the Chinese visitor was a journalist for Global Times, and then wrote an article about his or her experience complaining about Cambodian corruption at the airports.
Let's move on, because we're running short on time. The third chapter, you offer a case study of avian flu. Why was this case study important and useful for you?
I happened to be studying at the time, and still do, the issue of how countries declare or not declare outbreaks. And so it gave me the opportunity to examine one situation. You know, Cambodia had an outbreak of avian flu, and several people died, continue to die annually. And at the point in time in which I'd written this chapter, the interesting thing was that Cambodia was receiving per death more money than other countries. It was getting quite a bit of support. It had managed to wrestle resources from donors in a way that suggested that it had portrayed itself as really quite a basket case, in terms of unable to figure out even its first victim, for example, a young woman who died in a Vietnamese hospital and whose sickness had to be revealed by the Vietnamese authorities to the Cambodian government as by the way, one of your citizens came across the border and died in our hospital, and she had avian influenza. And then in quick succession, the next really seven victims die, and finally the first to survive is this guy who's discovered by the U.S. Naval Area Medical Research Unit 2. So, you know, an external party and an external entity operating in Cambodia doing these studies randomly stumbles upon a victim of avian influenza and reveals it to the authorities, and this is the first person to survive, and the next one is also found by Namru too and survives, and it portrays, I think, a very interesting sort of situation in which, you know, a country like Cambodia, you know, has picked up a disease that some even argue might be the beginning of the next pandemic, and how does a country like Cambodia deal with that? How is it angle itself, and also why does it refuse to do the one thing that seems to make sense, which is, you know, to incentivize its farmers to report outbreaks of potential avian influenza to actually compensate those farmers when the authorities come to cull their poultry, so to kill their poultry. Yeah. Instead, Cambodia decides to in this interesting case to deviate from the desires of the international community and to instead refuse to compensate, which then disincentivizes all aspects of actually reporting, because, you know, if you do report something's wrong with your poultry and they come and kill your poultry, you'll get nothing. So why would you ever do that? You'd want to sell off as quickly as possible if you notice the problem with your poultry so that you could get rid of it and get some money at least instead of losing your shirt. But I think it's a case in which you can get your hands dirty and kind of see how a new problem is tackled in Cambodia and how the authorities kind of take advantage of the donors in that sense, you know, taking as much money as they can while not doing essentially the stuff that the donors wanted them to do.
But you don't let the donors off the hook or that much, at least the way I read it in the chapter. One of the things that you argue is that although donors were concerned about this culling without compensation, as you put it, at the same mm-hmm. time, the priority for the donors was avian influenza as a global emergency, as a health threat at an international level in which there was a high level of self-interest. And so ultimately, those concerns took priority over the needs and interests of the poor farmers who were affected.
They did, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. So, you know, donors are selfish, right? They're not there as simply altruistic do-gooders. They're there, and it was especially apparent in this case, to stop a disease from coming across the ocean and to their country. And if it meant that the poorest people in Cambodia were going to, as a result, lose their livelihoods, well, too bad. I mean, it was seen as a necessary evil. And regardless of the fact that the authorities, you know, were told, if you go forward with compensation, we'll help you. But the authorities just didn't want to do that. So the donors were willing to make essentially a deal with the devil and say, okay, well, you know, you get rid of the problem. And even if people's lives are, you know, if the cure is worse than the disease, then it's, you know, that's essentially what happened. The solution caused, I think, at that point in time, more damage than the disease itself. I mean, a few people certainly died, but lots of people's livelihoods were destroyed as a result.
The subtitle of the book, as I've mentioned already, is How Foreign Assistance Undermines Democracy. And it's in Chapter 4 that we get to the topic of shallow democracy, as you would describe it. What is this shallow democracy? And again, what's the part that foreign assistance has played in creating this low-quality democracy in Cambodia,
if right.
It can be called that?
Well, that was an interesting case study in which I looked at the arrests of human rights and labor rights activists and how democracy promotion organizations went about trying to trying to get Cambodians riled up and maybe create in their minds at least what they saw as a potential velvet revolution or orange revolution, whichever color you want, out of Europe, Eastern Europe, that they'd experienced, and to see the same happen in Cambodia. So it's interesting because there was what I observed to be a lack of recognition among these democracy promotion organizations with respect to Cambodia's history, a total lack of understanding that Cambodia had just come out of a genocide a few decades earlier, and now they were saying to protesters and to leading activists, it's not so bad. Jails in this notorious Prayasar prison isn't so bad. Look at they were saying, look at Kem Sokha. He's in a cell with a television, which he's sharing with this human trafficker who had become notorious as he had special privileges. But what wasn't mentioned was the others were actually in cells with a bunch of prisoners sharing all the facilities and suffering from potential exposure to tuberculosis, for example. But for a lot of these organizations, they just see it as a kind of opportunity to promote their agenda, and they don't understand that it's not that easy. You can't just get people to go to the streets and protest, and if they end up in jail, it's okay, because again, this mentality of you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Well, that's how genocides happen, because because even in the 1970s, I remember as an undergraduate writing my honors thesis about Western academic supporters of the Khmer Rouge, there were sympathizers, academic supporters of the Khmer Rouge, who wrote things like, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And by this they meant, some people are going to have to die in the process of, revolution. And of course, it's just a lack of understanding as to, the effects, especially when these foreigners can get on a plane and leave the country whenever they want. The irony, of course, is that they have complete freedom of movement and travel, and they can be out of there at a moment's notice. But the Cambodians who have to pay the price can't do that.
Well, in the Khmer Rouge period, at least one didn't succeed in that respect. But perhaps we shan't go back to that time, but concentrate on the present. And before we leave this chapter behind us and go to your conclusion, I wanted to draw one aspect of the chapter, and that's that you emphasize how a lot of the aid is delivered certainly to CSOs, to civil society organizations, but also to pillar institutions of the state or to projects that are involved in state-building activities around these pillar institutions. What are the difficulties that emerge, or are there indeed difficulties that emerge for the democracy in Cambodia out of this orientation of delivery of aid towards those institutions?
Well, the first problem is that there's a lack of sustainability, right? So, these CSOs receive money, and then the vicissitudes of donors change, and so they, what's fashionable one day changes to another a few years later, and they have to scramble. So they're donor driven. They don't own exactly what it is they'd like to do, because they basically have to jump at a moment's notice and try to continue to please their donors. USAID, for example, has supported democracy and governance for a number of years, but one day the democracy promotion organizations are in favor and are being told to speed things up on the demonstration front or the support of the opposition, and then another it might be, well, we're not seeing results, so we've got to change tactics, and it's understandable. I mean, Einstein did say that you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. But what I see is, of course, you know, relatively few donors still willing to play that, to stick it out and continue to support these sorts of activities. Increasingly, you see co-optation, you see a kind of a resignation that it's better to work within the system, with the regime, than to try to encourage reform from outside. And so you make all kinds of maybe compromises as a result, deals that you might not otherwise. But I generally speaking, you know, the funding picture has been bad for aid for quite some time, and especially for U.S. foreign aid. It just hasn't, you know, as a inflation adjusted measure, it just hasn't gone up dramatically at all. It stays at about the same, and if in fact it were adjusted for inflation, it would be in decline over the years.
The conclusion of the book is quite prescriptive. What are some of the recommendations that you have for dealing with the issues that you describe, and perhaps have you reflected on them in the period since you wrote the book? And which leads us into my next question as to what you've been doing in the meantime and what we can look forward to from you next.
Right. So, I mean, actually, I haven't looked at my prescriptions in quite some time because, frankly, I as you can see, I talk quite a bit. And so I haven't even reached, I seldom ever get to that point where I'm actually able to discuss those prescriptions. But you know, a few of the ideas are, for example, that policymakers and donors should be, you know, imposing stronger consequences for corruption. So making punishing countries for acts of corruption instead of turning a blind eye, for example. So when, you know, the Global Fund discovered corruption in its projects in Cambodia, It really tried to make the authorities pay back that money, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think that when corruption does happen, there ought to be a public accounting of it, and then, you know, some sort of a redress. There are lots of different examples where kind of donors instead choose to kind of, you know, sweep things under the rug and ignore the problem. Also that policymakers or donors should recognize the importance of collective action to overcoming sectoral problems and finding ways to encourage such action. There I'm thinking about problems in the, you know, livestock sector, for example, where, you know, in Cambodia and agriculture, there's just a lack of trust. So social capital has been destroyed. How do you get people to work together? How do you get people to actually build a cooperative how do you get them to cooperate and do things together? Not, of course, referring to a commune, because that would be bringing them back to the past and the experience of the Khmer Rouge, but to essentially work together as farmers so that they can have more power instead of being divided and as a result conquered. So donors can have, I think, more of an impact on collective action than they realize. And I think, you know, strengthening civil society as a counterweight to corruption is another idea. Now, civil society is still, you know, fairly weak. There are lots of organizations, but even in the recent example of the NGO and assembly law that was passed recently, while the NGOs protested, the real danger was really to non-NGOs, entities that bring people together but aren't necessarily registered. And you're already seeing the effects of that. There's a group that's fighting some sort of eviction somewhere in Cambodia, and they've already been told that they'll be arrested unless they register. And of course, this is where the problem comes in. If their registration is refused, then they're technically in violation, or if they're made to pay bribes to register, they'll be unable to continue their activities. So this is another way of controlling people, controlling large numbers of people, and it's essentially intimidating them into not going up against the state or against companies that have grabbed their lands, for example. So those are some of the original prescriptions. I would say, you know, what some of the things that I've certainly seen since then involve, you know, I think the fact that the authorities are improving now their collection of taxes. I think they realize that with a growing economy, you really do have to keep it up, because if you don't, you'll shrink in terms of a percentage of GDP, tax revenue as a percentage of GDP. And I think they're getting sort of the message that, you know, just the petty corruption needs to be curtailed. I think it's a dream to expect it to end completely, but curtailed. I think there's a realization that the more you scare away tourists and visitors who are bringing you money because you're not behaving normally, essentially, at the airport, for example, the more counterproductive it is, and the worse Cambodia's reputation will be globally for these kinds of shenanigans. So I think there's some waking up there. And certainly the biggest of all was the outcome of the election 2 years ago in July 2013. The surprisingly strong outcome for the opposition party. And the message that this sends for the ruling party that even if they control TV stations, even if they control radio stations, most except one, really, Beehive Radio, controlled by Mam Sinondo, and a lot of the newspapers, overwhelming majority of the newspapers, they can't control all information. They can't control Facebook, for example. They can't control how people communicate with other people. And they've sort of let the genie out of the bottle already, because, you know, I think at this point, if they start trying to curtail access to social media, people won't stand for that. So young people got the message, certainly, that the opposition leader, Sam Rangsi, was returning to Cambodia. And even though the TV stations didn't mention even his return, they showed up in 200,000 strong for that day. And it really showed that it really doesn't matter what they stop from being broadcast. Social media will break through. And that's a whole other ballgame that the authorities are now trying belatedly to get into with the youth and controlling some of the information they get.
And in a couple of minutes, what are you working on now, and what can we look forward to next?
So the work that I started with the avian influenza chapter has culminated in a series of articles that I hope can be assembled as a book shortly, essentially looking at the response of countries like Cambodia, Indonesia, Thailand, Kenya, Peru, and Mexico to outbreaks of diseases. So, you know, how did Mexico react to swine flu, and why did it react in a certain way? What explains a country's desire to be public with respect to its outbreak of a disease versus silent? And, you know, why would a country like Indonesia, for example, not want to share viral isolates, essentially viruses, with the rest of the world? Because, of course, it wanted to have, vaccines in exchange for sharing those viral isolates. So essentially looking at the securitization of health in the world today, and how it went from something that was, indisputable, something that everyone should cooperate with, to suddenly something that, you know, Indonesia refused to cooperate on, calling viral sovereignty over its virus samples, and others also realizing that, you know, they're not going to stand idly by and give away the only thing they hold that can give them access to vaccines later on, if they don't have an agreement a priori for sharing of the benefits from that exchange.
Fascinating. Well, we look forward to that work and what other work you have coming in the years ahead. So Paul Ear, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today about aid dependency in Cambodia. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Nick. My pleasure.
And thank you to everyone for listening. Please join me again for our next meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian Studies. And if you have time, check out the archive of interviews that are already online, available via iTunes and the show website, newbooksinsoutheastasianstudies, all one word, .com. Hey,